Hello and welcome to Radically Distinct Radio. I'm your host, Jen Morgan. And today our guest is Margaret Moen, who is an amazing soloist for the Pacific Northwest Ballet, host of a new podcast called Beyond the Bar, and director and producer of a documentary film called No Dominion, The Ian Horvath Story. I totally butchered his last name. Horvath.
Yes.
Okay, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
I'm excited to have you here.
Me too.
Yeah. Well, Maggie's my friend. Margaret is my friend, and I'm not supposed to call her Maggie because she's her professional name, but to keep her brand clear, Margaret Moen.
This is good. You know, the friend overlap is coming out already.
It's good. It's true. How was your day today?
It was busy. We are working very hard right now with, you know, we're performing next week. So it's kind of crunch time right now. So
at the ballet. It's so strange to me that you say work and you're talking about ballet because, I mean, obviously it's hard. I mean, I'm not even trying to say that. But like, what does that mean? What does it mean to be a working ballerina?
The fact that it is my day job to be a ballerina does not go past me as the fact that it's weird. Like, I realize that it's weird.
It's definitely unordinary.
Yeah, and it's something too that continually me and so many of my coworkers will always hear, oh, are you in school, or oh, what's your real job, or things like that. Like, no, it's hard for people to wrap their head around the fact that for 7.5 hours a day I'm being a ballerina. So
7.5 hours a day, you're actually, what does that mean? You're being a ballerina. Tell me.
So we have an hour and a half of class and we get little breaks throughout the day, but we have 6 hours of rehearsal a day. Some of that you won't always be in all of, but usually, especially leading up to a show or right before a show, you're pretty much guaranteed to have every hour of rehearsal each day. So yeah, we show up, we warm up all together, we get ready for the day all together, and then we rehearse together. Until we used to work till 7, and now we've adjusted our schedule earlier, so now we work till 6 each day. And then during shows, our schedule shifts further based on when the shows are. So
okay. And so do you then have to practice outside of your work day, or that is your practice?
We do cross train. A lot of us do other exercises to kind of subsidize what our bodies aren't getting. It's very physical, so you would think that you would get all you need through that day, but not everything is worked evenly through choreography. You're not doing everything the same amount to the right as you are to the left, things like that. Okay. Or using the same muscles that you would like to use for a different ballet. So it's, or something maybe that's coming up next. So there's the Pilates groups and things like elliptical, building stamina, yoga.
And that's in your own time?
Yeah.
In your own time? Okay, okay.
Yep.
And so what
in
else?
In our free time.
In your free time. So, but literally, it's like 7.5 hours of dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you keep yourself able to do that? I mean, 7.5 hours of literally like physical work.
Mm-hmm. It's really, being a ballet dancer is not having a lot of free time that way.
Mm-hmm.
In order to stay healthy enough to dance, we have to not only do things like the training, things like Pilates, things like elliptical, stuff like that, but we also have to, you know, the end of the day comes and probably going to sit in an ice bucket for 10 minutes or so, stretch out for half an hour, if not more, depending on how your body's feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Getting massages, seeing physical therapists, seeing doctors. It's like a lot of extra time spent just taking care of what you've done to yourself during the day. So it really, in a way, never stops. Over the weekend, you're taking care of yourself. At night, you're taking care of yourself. In the morning, you're getting ready mm-hmm. for your day, physically, whatever you need to be doing. So
you're very aware of your physical, your body all the
yes.
time.
Yeah.
Basically.
Definitely.
And do you, I don't know. There's just this idea that as a ballerina, you don't get to eat very much. But I know, because I taught aerobics when I was in college, mm-hmm. like, I'd eat all the time.
Yes.
literally all the time. So is that, how do you eat enough? Like, eat, period.
I mean, I eat a lot. I'm here to debunk that myth about ballerinas not eating a lot. I eat a lot. And that's the thing. When you're that active that much, mm-hmm. you really eat.
Mm-hmm.
You need to. It's the only way you can keep your energy up. I remember it was towards the end of the rep that we did at the end of the season in June. It was a really difficult rep. And I was exhausted and I was meeting a friend after, and I was like, I don't care where we go, but we're going somewhere where I can just eat a burger. Like, I just need a giant burger because I need some iron and I need something large and I'm dying and please feed me.
They're like, the ballerina needs a burger. Yeah, it just doesn't fit
immediately. And yeah, just throughout the day, I always have a good breakfast. Usually between I dance for an hour and a half and then I need a snack, and then I dance for another hour and I need another snack, and I dance for another hour and I need another snack. We all, some people, even as you're taking class, you can notice people trying to, you know, they're like watching a combination and eating stuff out of their dance bag. It's just, we get 5 minute breaks at the top of every hour because we're union, and every 5 minute break that I can, sometimes you have too many things going on, you have to change your shoes, run to the restroom, you don't always have time, but I always try to have some kind of snack and always have a very good lunch, especially if I know the last 3 hours of the day are going to be intense.
Now I have to know, what is a good snack then?
I think it's different for everybody. I'm definitely more of a carb person. I discovered that actually when I got a stress fracture a few years ago, I was told that I needed to be on a higher carb diet. So I'm usually having a lot of power bars and granola bars and things like that. And during my lunch, I try to always have some definite grain, whole grain sandwich, or, you know, bread with my sandwich, and pasta. I eat a lot of pasta. So
really?
For me, that's some people need more high protein diets. It just depends on your physicality, but for me, the grains really make a big difference. So
yeah, I mean, again, I'm not a ballerina, but I'm more of a high protein person. I'm not actually, so if I don't have enough protein in my diet, I get really I get kind of sad, and also I just don't have any strength.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, just something for me that's always to be more of a high protein diet.
And it's interesting, people's bodies are so different that way, which is something that you discover as you're becoming a professional. You start noticing what helps you, what doesn't. So yeah.
And what does it take? So also, I think in my mind, to be a ballerina, there would be maybe more body issue. Like, of course, I think women in general struggle with our image of our body because of lots of reasons. But in your world, I mean, people are staring at your body while you're on the stage. So that's like a big part of your, you know, your value proposition, right?
Yeah.
So is there a lot of, I don't know, I don't even know what to say, like body issues that would be eating disorders or challenges like that? Or do you not make it?
I think it's funny. I think it's such an interesting issue for the dance world because it's a little different everywhere. I luckily work in a place where a lot of us are very different and it's not frowned upon that way. Not that there aren't issues every once in a while, but yeah, I mean, it's funny. So dancing this much pretty much puts you in good shape. Whatever your body is like, you're looking pretty good. Like, I think we're, as a dance culture, beyond the need of starvation, because number one, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You can't execute what you need to do that way. And also, it's not smiled upon like it was way back in the day. People want to see healthy people on stage. Directors who are our bosses want to have healthy dancers. And if you are not taking care of yourself, not eating enough, injuries happen, weaknesses happen. And I think it's all kind of adding up to a culture of more health overall.
Yeah.
And also there's more dancers stepping forward to be positive images that way too, which helps. It is a lot of pressure to put yourself out there that way. And every once in a while, I find myself thinking about it. I can't lie about that.
Like thinking what? Thinking like I don't look good enough? Or
just, you know, when you're used to, you see a lot of incredible bodies during the day and things that maybe are so different from yours. And you're like, oh, man, I wish I looked more like that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, just, which all of us do.
to
everybody. But luckily there's enough. And for me too, I find it's so important to be a positive role model that way. I'm not willing to go down that kind of road, and other people aren't either. You have someone like Catherine Morgan or Misty Copeland, dancers that are really making a big stand about that bodies are different and all bodies can be beautiful and all bodies can be strong and do this well. And so I feel the need to be a part of that versus the other. So I don't ever go there with myself. Yeah. I'll think about it for a minute and be like, no, do you want some other girl following you to think that way? No, you don't. So, yeah.
Yeah. So you think of it about being a role model. Mm-hmm. And really, and I know you, and I know that you really take it to be an honor to achieve mm-hmm. the level that you've achieved. I mean, it's, so what does it take to achieve the level? I mean, can you tell me maybe a couple pivotal points where you yourself had to decide, no, this is what I want, mm-hmm. and like put in, you know, kind of dig in. Give it all you got.
Yeah, definitely. For me, I had an interesting transition to where I am. A lot of my coworkers and a lot of professional dancers tend to have the experience where they go to school, you know, probably maybe freshman, sophomore year, and then they go away to a dance-focused school where they dance all the time with other dancers. They take school with other dancers. They're in a different environment. I was actually lucky enough to stay home through my entire high school education. Mm-hmm. I had a great school that I was training at in my hometown, which is not common for everybody. It's not. I'm from Tucson, Arizona, so it's... The odds were small, but in my favor that way, that there was such a great school for me to just stay home at. But it also, it made me have to make a decision about it even more so in a way, because I wasn't just with a bunch of other dancers and everyone gets it and everyone wants to do the same thing and we're competing against each other as a whole. I was surrounded by, I actually went to a huge high school. There were 1,500 kids in my graduating class. Really, really big school. Mm-hmm. Pretty much no one danced. So the level of understanding was not there. And even for my teachers too, I remember having trouble with some teachers when I was in high school where I would miss, I would, you know, get excused absences from the school to do a show or something. And not all the teachers looked favorably upon that mm-hmm. or were supportive of that because they didn't get what I was doing. They're mm-hmm. like, okay, you're missing for what now? I don't mm-hmm. understand. So I feel like I was almost, it almost made me have to take a stand for it even more because I was always having to explain what I was doing and why I was doing it so much. I missed my prom to do Swan Lake my senior year. Yeah. You know, just things like that that other kids that I was going to school with didn't understand. I had friends that were supportive of it, but that didn't dance. But at the same time, it was even a lot of educating them about the fact that I danced 7 days a week in high school.
Yeah.
And my weekends were, you know, I was pretty much dancing from 10 or 11 to 7 at night every single weekend. Mm-hmm. I was dancing till 8 or 9 on Friday nights. It's just, so actually, I think that, for me personally, push it even farther. You know, I think the more common experience is the feeling of really having to, oh, I really want to do this because I'm going away. Like, I'm willing to leave home to do this. And that's a huge statement to make, too. But for me, it was the opposite, but also strong in the way that I was home. But I was just constantly like, no, this matters to me because of this. I feel, you know, mm-hmm. feel this way. No one gets it. And that's okay. I still feel that way about it, even though no one's understanding yeah. besides my other dance friends. So, yeah. For ballet companies, what they look for you to do as a young student is to take summer courses at different schools. PNB has a summer course every year. And I had actually been to that summer course 4 times. And on the 4th time, I was planning on coming back home to Tucson, actually, and working and saving up money for company auditions and joining the company in Tucson and just staying there until I could find a really good job somewhere else. And then they asked me to stay, surprisingly, as a student, and made it very worth my while to do so financially because I couldn't afford a lot. And so I ended up moving up to Seattle a month after I graduated, very unexpectedly. And so, and that put out in a whole another perspective is of, oh my God, I'm here. And mm-hmm. I've talked about wanting to do this a lot to all these people that didn't get it. And now here I am amongst all these kids that have been surrounded by dance people all the time. And so it was an interesting process for me. But
how long ago was that?
That was 2007. I came out to be a student here.
Okay.
Yeah, it's been a while ago.
And so you were a student and then you become like a cast member?
Mm-hmm. I was a professional student professional division student for 1 year. And then, so professional division for PNB and a lot of big companies have some kind of version of this. You are not necessarily looked on as a straight up student, but you're also not a company member. You're very much not a company member. Mm-hmm. So you'll maybe perform alongside the company, filling in for core roles where they don't have enough company members, things like that. But you're still a student, but you're not, you know, doing the after school situation. You're there at the same time the company's there in the morning. Like mm-hmm. that's your schooling. You wake up at 8, have class, or not wake up at 8. You have class at 8:15 or 8:30 and you're dancing all day mm-hmm. alongside the company, but not as a part of the company.
Right.
And it's looked at to number one, push your training forward to becoming a dancer because it's that many hours that's getting you ready for that. But it's also to set you up for auditions. Mm-hmm. Being a professional division student at a major company means more company directors from other companies are going to come look at you because you're at this really great school and they're assuming that all these students are going to be great and they're looking for apprentices for the following year for their company. So it's a good place to be seen. And I was primarily there for that too, because it's so nice when you don't have to fly all over the country auditioning for companies and directors come to you. Yeah. That really is cost effective for a young person. So it's a good position to be in that way. And so really it's another level of change though, because you are a student with these other kids for a year or 2 years or maybe more, and you're all trying to find jobs. And so it goes and you go from this big group to this person got hired here, this person got hired here. Then so you all just disperse at the end of the season. So it's an interesting dynamic.
So my dad was a really great hockey player when he was young. And then when he got to the point where he had to decide to go, I think it would be like minor leagues. I can't remember what it was mm-hmm. called. But, you know, but you're not quite good enough for professional, mm-hmm. right? But you were going to like the next step after I guess junior leagues or something. And he actually made a decision that he wanted to pursue like partying and girls. He didn't want to commit anymore. I remember you told me that story and I remember thinking like, oh, I'm interesting that you chose that. But I mean, you know, for him it was like, you know, that meant also working, mm-hmm. right? You know, so like I'm not gonna choose. So was there a point for you to decide? Like, no, I'm gonna, obviously you got that, but there must be pivotal moments where you had to decide, oh, this is my profession, like I'm going for this.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, I made the call very, very early. I think a lot earlier than a lot of people. It's because you're right, it's your dad is very correct. It's challenging to commit that much time to being disciplined at a young person. Mm-hmm. Like we make decisions about our careers because our career is short. We have to make a decision about it very early on in general. But I made it when I think I was probably 11, actually. I wanted to be a ballerina romantically, so but I actually had my parents were divorced and I had a dad that was just really, really unsupportive and really fought me on dance, like did not want me to dance, had never seen me perform, wasn't willing to be there for anything that way. So the fact that I had to kind of take arms against my dad that way made it really count very early on. And I had questions about it in high school only because it's so demanding. And I had a really serious injury when I was a junior in high school. I was out for almost a year from dancing. I'd sprained my ankle so badly, actually twice in a row, that it was kind of looking rough for a while for me to even make it back. And then when I did make it back, it was just very difficult to catch up again with my classmates. I'd been doing it consistently the whole time that I had been out. And so I did have a moment of, you know, of questioning it then, just because it was just so hard and I felt so much pressure. But it goes back, honestly, to my dad, having to, you must feel strongly about something if you're willing to stand up to your parent about it in that way. And mm-hmm. so it was really definitely that for me, that every time I've had that feeling where it gets hard and I'm like, oh my God, I don't know if I can do this anymore. So much pain, things like that. It goes back to like childhood, really, of just remembering that and what that felt like and how much it meant to me that I was willing. Like I did not falter back then. Like, no, I was like, no, this means the world to me.
You were determined.
Yeah.
You were determined to make it happen. So. That's awesome. Okay. So then what happens when do you decide, okay, so there's one thing where you're like, no, this is what I want. And then when did you decide, like, you're good enough? You know what I mean? Because you have to somewhere believe, like, I can actually do this. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you can't put it, you're all into it, right?
Yeah. It's funny. I think it happened for me. I still question myself all of the time.
Of course.
However, I think where I really started pushing hard was when they implemented a professional company as a part of my school. There had always been a company, but there were some adults there, there were some students, but when they decided to really establish a fully professional company attached to the school, I was a freshman and...
In high school.
A freshman in high school. And at that point, the company was just 10 dancers. Now it's much bigger and it's really self-sustaining and it's great for the kids. But when they first started, it was so small that they still needed us too, mm-hmm. Which was an interesting dynamic. And I remember there was a company member that was so mean to me. She was just awful. And the other ones were great. She was her own issue. But she and I ended up sharing a lot of roles. And I was a freshman in high school and she was an adult. And the fact that she was that mean to me and we were sharing these things, it's like, I took such offense to it in a retaliation kind of way.
Competitive, right? You're
like, yeah, I was just...
I ought to beat you.
Yeah, I was like, you know, it felt so ridiculous that she was being that way to me. And I was like, you know, I'm going to show that I can do this better than you. And I'm, you know, how much younger than you. So it kind of...
My competitive spirit.
It kind of lit a different kind of fire under me unexpectedly, but it was because of that dynamic. I otherwise was not generally that kind of person. I always felt like a weaker person in my class. I grew up with a very strong class of girls. Like, the girls were amazing that I trained with. And so I always felt like the weak link there. But being pushed that way, being poked at that way, mm-hmm. just kind of hit me just the right way where I was just like, no. And so I kind of... So I've kind of had that reaction. I had that reaction again when I was a professional division student. I didn't face the same kind of thing, but when I felt that kind of commotion, it felt familiar to me. The girls I trained with as a PD were actually great, but it was a similar, dynamic as far as how we were training. You were all sharing parts, you're all at the same level, and, you know, that kind of thing. So... And also just being so desperate for a job, I was like, I have to show that I deserve a job. So, but yeah, it was definitely the high school experience is where I first visited that. And then just trying to show that I came to be a part of the program to get a job. I needed a job. I think, too, it's interesting. Ballet is such, it's a very expensive thing to do. And I came from, you know, I was raised by my mom and my grandmother, and we did not have a lot of money. My mom works at my home studio, actually. She started there. I think I'd been at the school for about 4 years before she started working there. But we didn't have a lot. And even for summer courses, I couldn't go anywhere unless I got full scholarship. It was very clear to me, you have to get in and you have to get full scholarship. And so to then be, you know, I was not going to waste the experience of being a professional division student, because here I am, all these people are going to see me, and I wanted the job, but I also knew I had to take care of myself too. So the survival instinct in me is very strong. So when I feel, I don't always feel deserving of great opportunities, but I always feel strongly that I need to survive. So that more than anything, lights a fire under me to push really hard and recognize my talent, because that's when it's going to help me, you know, provide for myself. So, yeah.
Interesting. So what do you think makes you or a ballerina stand out and move forward? You know, obviously there's different levels, right? You move from one school to the next school.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's about being well balanced. I think a lot of students, I watch it all the time, they don't look at the full picture enough. I think something that makes people successful within a bigger company, because there's so many of you, is general work ethic more than people realize. And it's also acknowledging your own strengths and also not expecting to be handed anything, because I think it's common for people that have had their moment in the sun as a student to assume that's going to happen again. And I think the healthiest mindset is to never assume that you're going to be someone's favorite. it's great when it happens, but mm-hmm. you have to be prepared that that's not going to be a thing. Mm-hmm. You're not constantly going to be told that you're doing great.
Yeah,
it might not happen for months on end. And it doesn't mean that your boss doesn't think that you're great. It just means that he has a whole group of over 40 people to take care of, and he yeah. doesn't have time to pat everyone on the back. You know, in our case, we're, you know, I think we're 45 or 46 dancers right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's too many people for any person to coddle. So I think it's really just a general taking care of yourself mindset. It's the people that, do the work even when no one's looking
yeah.
that end up at least surviving well within the company, maybe not being, you know, the ballerina or the favorite, but you can work towards those things. And every person that comes through the doors looks for something different. Choreographers look for something different in dancers all the time. So it's mm-hmm. being flexible, being open-minded, and also, again, realizing that you're not always going to get the attention that you would love. It would be great for all of us to have yeah. one-on-one coaching all the time. And they do their best. It's not like they ignore people, but... But yeah, I think it's that more than anything, because people, I think it's easy to become complacent.
Yeah.
When you feel like you're not getting the kind of attention that you want. So
okay, I can relate to that. Yeah. I understand what you're saying. So now I want to know, how does somebody go from being company mm-hmm. to soloist, which you're a soloist?
Yes.
And what does that actually mean? And how'd you get there?
It's different for everybody. It's so much right place, right time sometimes for these things. For me personally, it was a pretty gradual progression, but it was a lot of, I was thrown a lot of opportunities really quickly, which I so appreciated, but I also realized that I had to rise to those opportunities.
Yeah.
So
what is it? Because some people might not know. I mean, I assume a soloist, like all of a sudden it's a show all about you.
Oh, no. No, not quite. So most companies, you have apprentices, which is a pretty small group. They're just coming in. Then you have the corps de ballet, which is the largest group of people in the company. Then you have soloists, and then you have principals. So soloists, you're not the highest level of the company, but you're working towards that.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. Not everyone becomes a soloist. It's a great, great honor to be a soloist. And again, in my case, I was very lucky. I worked really hard as an apprentice to show my versatility and show how hard I was willing to work. And luckily, through my first couple of years in the Corps, I was given a ton of opportunities to learn major roles in either sink or swim, and pushed as hard as I could to swim. And
you obviously did.
Yeah. And luckily it added up to that. But it's ballet and the arts in general, it's difficult because it's very personal. Everyone has a different preference.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the other challenge of being a dancer, is really finding the right place for you.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is a personal, you're being judged.
Where your yeah. style fits.
Like what you look like, what you dance like, what you move like, what you think like. Mm-hmm. You just have to find the right boss for that.
Okay.
I feel lucky that I was able to be a soloist in this company, because I'd wanted to be here, and I'm lucky that my experience has added up to that, because it doesn't happen for everybody. So, yeah.
Yeah. So do you tell me? Okay, so I would imagine for some, like, how many people do you perform for?
I think our theater seats about 4,000.
4,000 people you dance
Pretty
in front
sure.
of. Do you ever have like performance anxiety?
Definitely. No, I definitely do.
What is that like for you? Perform? I mean, geez, 4,000 people. You're like yeah. standing there. The curtain's about to go up. What mm-hmm. the heck are you thinking about?
It's changed a lot from year to year for me, which is interesting. I went through a phase in high school. I wasn't dancing for that many people, but I went through this phase where I was just always really excited to get on stage. And I felt that too when I first came and joined the company. And actually, it's funny. It was both the opportunities that set me up for a promotion and the opportunity that led to my anxiety. Not... you know, intentionally, so obviously by my boss or anything, but I had such a high reverence. I think it was, I was surprised when I got hired. I was hoping, you know, you hope that you're going to get hired where you want to get hired, but I was actually kind of shocked when it did happen. Mm-hmm. I wanted it. And then it was like, oh, wow, okay.
Yeah.
And I was given all these great opportunities that I never thought I'd get to touch mm-hmm. for many years. And I think it comes from my training a lot. There was a lot of, even though I danced alongside the company, at the end of the day, there was always that very strong hand saying like, okay, you great. You danced alongside the company, but you're still down here and you're still going to have to work for years to dance this kind of role and that kind of thing. So that was just kind of ingrained in me. Uh-huh. And so it was very shocking for me, my first couple of years being so young, to get to dance these parts, and especially dancing with dancers that I had looked up to for years. I was very intimidated by it. They were kind, but I don't even think they realized the level of anxiety that I was feeling about stepping into their shoes mm-hmm. in that way.
Yeah.
So I went through about 3 years of fighting it off that way, you know, feeling that way, but making it through,
like
still
pretending.
Having a good time. Yeah, just like, okay, get it together, and still getting it together enough.
Yeah, like muscling it.
Yeah, like pushing it aside. I was able to push it aside, okay. Luckily.
And just like you were like faking it till you make it. Like,
yeah,
I'm
exactly.
Like,
yeah. You know, I think it was, again, that survival thing.
Yeah.
Like I felt it, but then I was like, oh, but I have to go on stage and I have to do this now. And so I better do it. So I had that experience for a bit. And then I had a turning point a couple of years ago, actually, where all of a sudden I got. It went from the difference between the general feeling of stage fright mm-hmm. to performance anxiety mm-hmm. That was really, really kind of crippling for me. I experienced a few different things happening at once. My grandmother, who raised me, had a major stroke, which really affected me. And then we had a family friend that was like a dad to me pass away. Mm-hmm. And I did my best to try to deal with both of those things as well as I could. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting. I all of a sudden had a lot of family stuff start creeping in that I hadn't let myself fully deal with.
Yeah.
And that started triggering performance anxiety for me. And mm-hmm. a lot of it, I think, in the passing of this family friend that was, you know, again, such a wonderful man and such a great figure for me, not having because my dad was no longer part of my life from the time I was 11 on mm-hmm. and I had to make that choice. So this, you know, someone that was such a great dad and all these amazing things and took me under their wing in this way, losing him all of a sudden triggered all these things that I
what else could I lose kind of thing.
Yeah, it yeah. just it hadn't my dad had actually passed away my apprentice year in the company, but we hadn't spoken in so long mm-hmm. and so it was kind of it was an odd experience because it was difficult. You know, it's difficult to lose a parent, but not in the same way as when yeah. you haven't spoken to them in that many years.
Yeah.
So it was just a really negative experience for me. And I realized, it's funny, just I think a lot of us don't realize when these little things in the back of our head can come forward again.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely had that experience. And all of a sudden, all the feelings of all the times I had to justify to him about dancing kind of crept up in the way of, well, you spent so much time justifying it. Are you really good enough to do this now? And so it started taking that form in my yeah. head. And I went through about a year. This was over a year ago, but I went through a year where I was just terrified every time I stepped on stage, even though I had been with the company, you know, for a while and danced really high level roles. All of a sudden, I was petrified. And it was also at a time of transition. A lot of new people were joining the company. A lot of great people were joining the company. So it was just like this perfect storm of, you know, more competition, you know, as far as yeah. the roles go, and this feeling, and I didn't feel like I was cutting it.
Yeah.
And
was there like did you get help?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's a thing. I feel really lucky that when I was a kid, when I was dealing with things with my dad, my mom had me see someone as a little kid, which was, it was, thank God, it was so important because these things are too serious or too complicated to deal with on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind
of know that you're dealing with
yeah,
that.
Yeah. And I've always tried to be a really reflective person. Mm-hmm. I really try to look inwards a lot mm-hmm. and analyze myself. And I was like, you know, do I want to live like this? No. Like, I love my job. I love where I am. I don't want to let it all slip through my fingers with these feelings. Like, clearly I need help.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to experience this every day of my life. And every time I go on stage, I don't want to feel that way.
Yeah.
And so I sought someone out. We're lucky enough where we're unions, we have health insurance. I went through my insurance providers and found someone wonderful that deals with performance anxiety in athletes. And I saw her for about a year, and it made such a huge difference. And actually, I found out at the end of last season that another coworker of mine had done the same. Mm. And yeah, I think it's funny too. I teach every summer, and I actually spoke to some of my students about this, that the fact that I did see someone, and I think it's 2016. It's nothing to feel ashamed of anymore. I think a lot of people put a lot of pressure on themselves that they have to deal with everything mm-hmm. themselves, or it means they're not, you know, cutting it. They shouldn't be doing that if they can't deal with it. But that's not true.
Yeah.
And I put too much work in, and I had felt too determined too many times in my life to go out like that. I wasn't going to let that be the way that I ended my career.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to end my career anymore, but I couldn't, or anytime soon, but I couldn't then do my job how I wanted to do, you know, how I should be doing it if that was what was happening. So
I didn't feel like you were able to show up and be your best. And
yeah,
I mean, it just had been a lot of loss can really cause.
Yeah. And I wasn't gonna quit. So it was like, what were my options? And I try to mm-hmm. look at things as logically as I can in life. And it's like, okay, your option is you quit or you live your life in fear. Those are terrible options. Yeah. So let's find a different option that makes you able to do, do what you want to do for as long as you want to do it. And it made such a big difference. And I think, you know, everyone's experience that way is different. But the person that I found worked really well for me. So
what did she get you to do? Like maybe just like a tip for someone who might have performance anxiety? Like what was a couple things that she had you do?
Well, a couple things that we did were we looked back a lot, actually. Dance focused, looking back that way. We talked about the things that brought these emotions up, obviously, but we definitely looked back a lot at times that I did feel confident mm-hmm. and just kind of internalizing that feeling again. And even just, it's interesting the mind is such an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. even just color triggers, like what was one of your favorite shows that you did where you felt super confident, you were so excited, what color were you wearing? Like even things like that mm-hmm. can be a trigger, listening to that music. And gradually, I've weaned myself more and more off of it. I'm not seeking out, having been through a certain thing, I followed through with certain things for a while. I still do some of the things. I don't need to do all of the things anymore, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was really, actually, I would say a lot of just highlighting the times where I didn't feel that way mm-hmm. and trying to figure out why and trying to remember find little moments that would bring that spark back where I don't feel that way.
Like emotional memory of good things instead of like your fears.
Yeah, and I feel, and I definitely feel lucky too that in the year that I was dealing with that, I was also cast really well with friends, which was helpful
mm-hmm.
Because I was not only trying to find the joy for myself in, you know, being on stage again and mm-hmm. Moving past that kind of fear, but also to do that with friends is like the ideal situation. You know, there's nothing better than being on stage with your friend and playing to them, and they're giving you everything you want back, eye contact, smiles, you know. So it ended up being a great year for me that way, actually, because I felt like I was able to not only rise above that through the work I was doing on the side, but also have fun on stage in those moments with my mm-hmm. friends. Like there is no better feeling to me than, I mean, being on stage is amazing anyway, like rediscovering. I had always felt that way, and then I just lost it for a while, and now I've gotten it back. Mm-hmm. But also like there's beyond nothing better than having that experience with a really good friend.
Yeah, I think
like it's the
like
best.
Deeply felt. Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Those are always my most memorable shows, or when I was doing something with a dear friend of mine. So,
well, I recently saw you in Romeo and Juliet, and you were the nurse.
Yes.
And and I thought I just could not believe how emotional you were. You know, and I mentioned that to you. You told me about your experience mm-hmm. of how you got to that performance and the directors and what they. So tell us a little bit about how you prepared for that show, because mm-hmm. you know, for you, for those of you who have never seen Romeo and Juliet at the Pacific Northwest Ballet, just had this, I would call it like a frenetic energy. It was a very fast, very emotional. The way that she moved was very precise, and it stood out on the stage, you know, because it's like a love story and there's a lot of depth and emotion. And she does this like high, upbeat, emotional interpretation of this character, which I was just like, where are you getting all that energy? And oh my gosh, it's so emotional. So tell me about the prep for that.
First, just even about the role, you nailed it on the kind of energy. And it's funny, that kind of energy is actually what makes the character so effective, and it's why they put so much pressure on that character. The people that work with us on this ballet are from the company it was created for. The director is the choreographer of that company, Ballet Monte Carlo. Mm-hmm. And they are very deep inside the work emotionally. They want it to be as authentic as possible. And they are also very detailed about it. And they're very specific about who does it and what kind of person. And the amount of time you get coached on it is extraordinary. We don't spend, you know, we do a lot of different works a year, and it's hard to spend much time on everything. We spend a lot of time on that ballet because of how they work. And that's how they're used to working all the time, is just crawling inside these characters and chipping away at every possible level and every possible moment that should be affected for the audience.
And more specific on that, like, what I remember you saying that they were like, give me more. Like, you just lost everybody in your life.
Yeah, they talk you through your character in a way that I've never been talked through.
Tell me.
Yeah, it's, so in the case of the nurse, you're kind of comic relief for a lot of the ballet, which is very intentional for the last act of the ballet, because everyone is kind of loving you. You're fun, you're cute, you're fast and, you know, kind of ditzy and all these things. They make that very, you know, they're very specific about how you are ditzy and when you're ditzy.
Okay.
When you're cute and when you're being a little sassy. But it's the turning of the tables that makes the final act so effective for our character. And that's why they push you so much to be both ends of that, because you are this light, happy, you know, nurturing person in Juliet's life. And then in this version, there is a fight between Juliet and the nurse, and it's very, very intense. The way they talk you through it, it's pretty incredible. They talk to you about why you're fighting, which I feel like a lot of people don't do enough in coaching of roles. They're like, oh, well, you're mad now. It's like, well, why am I mad? And it's you spend a lot of time being really encouraging of her and Romeo. You want her to be happy, but then there comes a line and she's throwing her life away and you can't have it anymore.
Juliet is throwing her life away to be with Romeo.
Okay. She's disobeying her parents. Her parents are the main figure of the parents is Lady Capulet in this version. Mm-hmm. And she's basically now being shunned by her mother. She just totally, by not wanting to marry Paris, it's over. And it's kind of that, they told me, you know, it's that moment of the ultimate kind of motherly frustration. It's like, okay, I tried to be supportive. You've had your fun, but this is serious now. You're throwing your whole life away for this guy that you barely know. Mm-hmm. You can't do this. And so it's just this breaking, like, you want her to be in love, but you also want her to be taken care of. And now you know that now that she's alienated her parents and in this way, she's not going to be taken care of, you know, mm-hmm. who's this guy kind of thing. And so you want more for her than that. So it triggers this whole really deep level fight where you can't support her anymore. And you're trying to explain to her why, but she won't listen at all. And it's this really angsty, intense moment. And they want you to go there with each other. And luckily, I did a lot of work on it this time with Nolani Pentesco, who had left to be part of their company and now has come back to our company. And she's actually nominated for a Genius Award by The Stranger for this role. She's incredible in it, and she goes there with you. Mm-hmm. And so we would have... They want you to hold on to that so much because the next time we come on stage, and actually the last time we come on stage, is we discover her dead.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had this fight, and they talk you through every little step of the next entrance. You come on very quietly, and you're not supposed to be sad. It's such a hard it's such a hard entrance because you're down, but you're not sad. And they're so specific about that because you're not supposed to know that she's dead yet. Yeah. And if you look too sad, then people don't get what's happening.
Yeah.
You come in because you feel bad that you fought. It's like that. And it makes me, it's interesting. It's a role that makes me really feel for parents in that way, in a way that I think I never have before. Not that I, you know, haven't felt for my own mother before, because teenagers are, you know, we're all kind of a nightmare when you're a teenager. But just thinking about that side of it, you don't want to fight with them. Mm-hmm. And you're coming in, you don't think you're wrong, though. You come in, you want to talk, like, as a nurse, I'm coming in, I want to talk to her. Mm-hmm. I feel really bad that I yelled at her. I've never yelled at her like that before. Mm-hmm. It hurts that I yelled at her, but I don't think I'm wrong. But I'm trying to find the right words to say. I'm sorry you fought, but I'm not sorry about what I said. I still believe in what I said. And so it's this really complicated entrance, and they want you to have all these things going through your mind.
Yeah.
And then you're trying to find the right words, and you can't seem to. And then finally, you're like, just, you know, listen to me. It's going to be okay. And then that's when you discover that she's dead. And that is the hardest moment, is showing how the way that they want you to demonstrate the shift.
Mm-hmm. Believing it, right?
Yeah, the shift from going to talk to her, like, just listen to me, and then everything stops. The whole world changes because you've just now discovered that she's dead. Mm-hmm. And what kind of reactions you have after that. And they talk you through that. So it's a very intense third act. I did it every show this run. Mm-hmm. So I did it, was it 8 or 9 times? 8 or 9 shows with 2 different Juliets. And it's very draining. And I was telling you, they always want more. I remember dress rehearsal. I gave it all that I had. I had the fight, and I remember sitting backstage, and I just had to be isolated from everybody because I was trying to hold on to those feelings. Mm-hmm. For a good amount of time. It's a large amount of time that passes between you leaving and you re-entering for that final scene, and just trying to hold on to that, not looking at anyone, just like in my own head. Yeah. The whole time. And then making that entrance, and as soon as I got off, I was actually crying on stage. I just like let it all out and came off stage, and I like could not stop crying for like the rest of the ballet backstage, looking like a crazy person. And they found me after, and they're like, oh, so it was really good, but even more, just you blast everything. And I just remember that feeling, like, I don't know if I have anything else. And like, they really push you to just think about all the loss that you've ever experienced. And so that's it was basically the feeling like, okay, so you genuinely want me to have an emotional breakdown on stage. Like, that's the only thing that will be satisfactory. But it's also what makes the production so special. But that's really the feeling. I was just would empty myself out every single show. Wow. So, yeah.
Wow. See what goes into this. You got to go to the ballet. They're so good. They are so good here. All right. So I want to just give you an opportunity to talk about your film before we we've been talking for a while, and we haven't gotten to so many things we could talk about.
I know.
So and I butchered his name, and he's an amazing man. And I know that you're really passionate about this project. You've decided that mm-hmm. you want to make a film. Tell us why you're making this film.
Yeah, so I'm making this film. I fell in love with this piece when I was in high school, actually. And it never, for all the amazing choreography I dance at PNB every year, it never left my mind, which I think says a lot about the work. And I thought it would look great on film. So it started as just a small idea. And then when I learned about how much he had done for especially the dance community, Ian Horvath passed away in 1989. And the fact that he was very integral in creating so many of the opportunities that I experience as a dancer today, and I never knew his name, just blew my mind, and I couldn't mm-hmm. not share that. And he was also a very passionate AIDS awareness advocate, also in the height of the 80s AIDS crisis, which was such a scary time. And I remember it hit me a certain way too, because my mom worked in Vidal Sassoon in the 80s mm-hmm. and experienced a lot of turmoil there with the fear, having to educate parents about, no, you can't get this from toilet seats. No, you're, you know, you're.
I remember that toilet seat thing.
Yeah, just, yeah. You know, there was so much misunderstanding and so much hate that was happening at that time. So to have someone that was so brave and stepping forward in that way, mm-hmm. it seemed like an incredible, I'm honored to share such an incredible story about such an incredible person. So it developed into a full length documentary film that mm-hmm. I'm lucky enough to co-direct and produce with a woman named Nell Shelby, who runs her own production company in New York, Nell Shelby Productions. And she's one of the best dance filmmakers there is in the country. And the two of us are coming together to make this film and share the story. And we restaged two of his pieces using dancers from five different companies across the United States. And mm-hmm. yeah, I think it's going to be a really remarkable film. And I just couldn't not share it with mm-hmm. the world. So.
And you're raising funds, right, for it? You're raising funds for it. And what? How do people find out more so that they can help you out?
Yeah, the most information you can find about the film is on our website. It's www.nodominionfilm.com. And you can find out about the film. You can also find links to follow us on social media and also to make a tax-deductible contribution. Our fiscal sponsor is $3 Bill Cinema, which is a local film company, LGBTQ mm-hmm. film company. And so luckily with their support, we are a nonprofit. So all donations are tax deductible and very mm-hmm. much appreciated. We've accomplished a lot so far. We've had a lot of filming done. We've mm-hmm. raised a lot of money, but we still have a lot more to go. So I really want to, this is going to be a great film, and I'm hoping that we can all come together to get it finished.
And
so,
how do we go check out it again? I want to just give you another chance to put the
website. www.nodominionfilm.com.
No. Okay, great. Nodominionfilm.com. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing, I mean, a lot of yourself with us today. I mean, I'm inspired by you, and I love coming to see you at the ballet.
Well, I'm so happy you do, and I'm also inspired by you, so this has been a great experience.
The RAD method is based on the same foundational principle as elite athletics. You can't control anyone or anything but yourself and how you show up in the world. How you show up in the world comes down to how you invest your time, practicing, developing yourself and your skills, and keeping yourself fit to perform mentally, physically, emotionally, and even spiritually. People who build their life, career, and business around this principle naturally rise to the top because they're able to stay engaged in all phases of the growth process when they experience loss, setbacks, failure, and anxiety. They do this by staying focused on the things they can actually do versus the things they have no control over. No one handed Margaret her position at Pacific Northwest Ballet. She won it, staying focused on the things she could actually control. She put in the work when no one was watching. She rose to the occasion when challenged by a competitor. And she got help with her anxieties when her anxieties became bigger than what she could handle alone. You don't have to be an athlete to rise to the top, but you do have to have the right focus. You can't control anyone or anything but yourself. Knowing what makes you radically distinct gives you a framework for pursuing your goals that puts you in a class of your own. You'll beat out your competitors by being 100% original and focused on the things about yourself that you can actually control. Hey, this is Jen Morgan. I want to empower you to be radically distinct. And there are many ways for us to work together. Whether you're an individual working on your career path or your life status, or you're a team or an organization, get a hold of me, jenmorgan.com. That's Jen with two N's, morgan.com. Email me, j@jenmorgan.com, and follow the show on Instagram and Facebook @radicallydistinct.